Ryan.
May it please the court. This court must determine whether the actions of the police officers in this case were reasonable and in conformity with the Fourth Amendment. This case is, the state believes that the actions of the police were reasonable for either or both of two reasons. One, they executed a search pursuant to consent by one with actual common authority to so consent, and or two, they executed a search pursuant to consent by one with apparent authority to consent to a search. This case is before the court on the state's petition to review a decision of the Court of Appeals, which reversed a judgment of conviction entered pursuant to Mr. Kiefer's guilty plea to a delivery of mushrooms charge. Prior to the guilty plea, Mr. Kiefer filed a motion to suppress evidence seized in the search of his home in April of 1995. This was a loft in a garage on the property owned by a Mr. Garlock. Mr. Kiefer challenged the search on the grounds that police, while they obtained the consent of Mr. Garlock to search the loft, acted unreasonably because Mr. Garlock did not have authority to consent to the search, and Mr. Garlock did not even have the apparent authority at the time of the search upon which police could reasonably rely for consent to search. The trial court rejected that challenge. The trial court concluded that Mr. Garlock had at least the apparent authority to consent to a search of this loft. The court did not address the question whether he had the actual authority to consent. The Court of Appeals reversed. The Court of Appeals concluded, in rejecting the state's argument that Mr. Garlock had actual authority, the Court of Appeals concluded that there was not sufficient proof of actual authority, and the court went on to conclude, in rejecting the trial court's determination that Mr. Garlock had apparent authority, the court concluded that the police did not make sufficient inquiry to determine whether Mr. Garlock had the apparent authority to consent to a search of this loft, and therefore their reliance on his consent to search the loft was unreasonable. There was also a separate issue regarding statements given by Mr. Garlock at the police station after his, I'm sorry, by Mr. Kiefer at the police station after his arrest. Mr. Garlock gave inculpatory statements at the scene in violation of Miranda. The trial court suppressed those statements at the scene because there was a violation of Miranda, but upheld the statements later given by Mr. Garlock at the police station because those were obtained, those were voluntary and obtained after full compliance with Miranda, and the court felt that there was a sufficient attenuation. And in so holding, it relied on this court's decision in State v. Anderson. In the Court of Appeals, the state argued that the trial court was correct, but focused its attention on the analysis in Oregon v. Elstad, the Supreme Court decision regarding statements obtained in violation of Miranda, which are suppressed, followed by statements which are obtained in conformity with Miranda later or thereafter. The Court of Appeals agreed with the state that the statements at the police station were admissible under the Oregon v. Elstead rationale. The state will proceed to address the search issue. Again, the question for this court, and the question which this court independently determines, independent of the lower court's determination, is the reasonableness of the conduct of police here. This requires close attention, close scrutiny to the facts presented to the officers at the time of the search and the facts developed at the suppression hearing. When we look at the record, there are many facts, and there are some conflicting facts, there are some undisputed facts, but we have to look at all of them. And one difficulty I have with this case is that the Court of Appeals selectively looked at the facts, as does Mr. Keefley. Again, we're looking at the reasonableness of police conduct. What did the police do and what did they know at the time of the search here? Police suspected that a John Zatera, who they believed had been selling illegal psilocybin mushrooms, was residing at the Garlock home. That's what they knew when they went to the Garlock home to investigate at 8:45 a.m. Sunday morning, April 9th. They knocked on the door. Mr. Garlock's wife answered the door. She immediately got Mr. Garlock, who apparently was in the shower. He came down, and they told Mr. Garlock, in very matter-of-fact tones, that Mr. Garlock's son, Scott, had been arrested the night before for possession of psilocybin mushrooms, and Scott had told them that John Zatera, who was staying at the Garlock house, had sold the mushrooms to him. They wanted to talk to Mr. Zatera. At that point, Mr. Garlock became upset because he made it clear that he does not want drugs in his home. And he told the officers that, yes, indeed, Mr. Zatera was there at the house, that he was staying in a loft out in the garage, along with Mr. Garlock's daughter, Dawn, and Mr. Garlock's daughter, son-in-law, John Kiefer. He immediately offered to take the officers out there to contact Mr. Zatera. In fact, if you look closely at the suppression hearing testimony of the three officers who were at the scene, you will see that, and I quoted at length that testimony in the reply brief, and I would appreciate the court taking a close look at that. I believe it's pages 3 through 7 of the reply brief. Mr. Garlock was adamant, and he said, basically told the officers, you can look wherever you want on this property because I don't want drugs here. They then asked about the living arrangements. Mr. Garlock told them that.
What was the exact question? I mean, did they say, what's the living arrangements here?
It's not clear what the exact question is. It may have been simply, do they pay rent? It's not clear one way or the other. The defendant and the Court of Appeals seemed to latch onto the idea that, oh, they only asked, does he pay rent? Do they pay rent? And he said no. Well, you know, in Illinois v. Rodriguez, which is the apparent authority doctrine case, the court doesn't say what questions is the officers asked. The analysis is what facts were available to the officers at the time of the search. Well, the facts available to the officers at the time of this search, not only was Mr. Garlock's response that they don't pay rent, but he also told them, and it is clear from the suppression hearing testimony, that Mr. Garlock told them, whether it was in response to questions, whether it was volunteered, this seemed to be a fairly free-flowing conversation between the officer and Mr. Garlock. Mr. Garlock told them, no, they don't pay rent, they help out with the electric bill when they can, they are staying there, quote, by my rules. He told them that there was no plumbing in this loft. There was no telephone service. They used the house. They observed that this was a single family sort of a residence, Mr. Garlock and his wife living in a house with a detached garage. They observe that there's only one entrance, one main entrance to the garage. There's not a separate entrance to the loft. They observed that they knew that Mr. Garlock told them that he was the owner of this property. They observed that he, in fact, lived there. They knew that Mr. Garlock was the parent of Dawn Kiefer and the father-in-law of Mr. Kiefer. And they were told by Mr. Garlock, you can look wherever you want. Officer Bushy testified at the suppression hearing to the effect if I can find it here.
Did they know there was no plumbing in the loft?
I'm sorry?
Did they know there was no plumbing in the loft?
According to the testimony at the suppression hearing, this is Officer Bush. First of all, he said, Mr. Garlock told us he didn't want any drugs on his property. He said we could search any place that we wanted to. And then he said, did anyone inform you that the utilities were locked? And Officer Bushy testified, yes. Robert Garlock said they, referring to his daughter and son-in-law, had to come in and use the shower and bathroom in the house because they don't have it out in the loft area. Furthermore, he stated that there was electricity in the loft, but sometimes they helped pay the electric bills. Officer Preby, and then he said, Bushy testified further, Garlock said they do not pay any rent and that there is no lease. Officer Preby testified, Garlock said he was the owner of the property, including the garage and loft area, and that they helped on the electric bill once in a while. Preby testified, Bushy testified as to his understanding of the living arrangements is that they used the entire house in the loft area. The loft is where they slept, but they came in the house to take their showers, to go to the bathroom, use the phone, and I would assume it's where they eat dinner. The loft is where they slept. Finally, Officer Otterbacher said Mr. Garlock told him that the barn, the loft, in his words, was on his property. Mr. Kiefer and his daughter did not pay rent. However, when they could afford it, they paid a portion of the electric bill. Furthermore, he said, Mr. Garlock said, there was no plumbing or telephone.
Just a question in that whole area. The fact, was it reasonable for the officers there was no question about whether Mr. Garlock could ever enter that loft by himself. In other words, his daughter and was living there with someone else. As I understand it, he had to get permission. He never went in there without knocking on the door, did he, Garlock?
Mr. Garlock told the officers that I usually knock before going in, and he told Officer Otterbacher, furthermore...
Was that giving an inference that sometimes I usually knock, but sometimes I go in without getting permission?
Well, I think that could lead to an inference. He did tell Officer Otterbacher, I knock, quote, out of respect. What that now maybe he never did enter without knocking, but I think from that answer it's reasonable for Mr. Garlock to believe that he could do so, and it's reasonable for the officers to believe that he had the authority to enter without knocking, even if he never did. Mr. Garlock did not testify. They won't let me in unless I ask. Furthermore, Mr. Garlock testified that they were staying on the property with his permission. And again, we're looking at what is really an informal living arrangement here. We have no written lease. We have an agreement to help out with electric bills.
Let's suppose we didn't have a written lease, we have a unit in a house. Which this is, and what kind of unit is another issue. As a matter of law, if this was a lease of an apartment in a duplex with the owner living in one of the units, would you agree that unless there was something very special here, that the landlord can't give permission to go into the tenant's unit?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that is similar to both the standard landlord-tenant situation where you have an absentee landlord, and I think Chapman of the United States is one case, and the hotel clerk situation who's on the premises and consents to a search of the room. And as a matter of law, that cannot be done absent some express consent by the defendant.
And it really wouldn't make any difference if the tenant paid rent or paid utilities or had a month-to-month or day-to-day. I mean, it just wouldn't matter.
Now, which tenant? Are we talking about the tenant
in the duplex?
In the duplex situation.
Yeah.
Well, I think you I think the formality of the living arrangements is relevant.
Well, if so, then the police officer, you put the police officer under an obligation to find out the formality. Then if that's your response, then the police officer has to ask those questions.
Well,
because if I understood your argument, it was we have to know what the officer knew when the officer went in. Not hindsight, not the facts, what the officer knew. Is that right?
That's right.
What the officer knew at that time. So if we're going to do a lot of formality, then we're going to have to see the officers to find out the formality.
Well, I think that the more information the officers have, the better, because, again, the analysis under Illinois v. Rodriguez is, were the facts available to the officer sufficient to warrant an officer of reasonable caution in the belief that this person had the authority to consent? So it's clear, just because someone consents doesn't make the search reasonable. So the officer has to have as much information as possible about the circumstances. So that's true. Evidence regarding the living arrangements is relevant. Now, plugging that into the facts here, it's clear that these three officers learned a lot about the living arrangements, whether they asked specific pointed questions or not.
Well, what they found out was that there was a separate unit. The unit did not have plumbing, which meant that it relied on the main house, right? So that there was some intermingling, unlike the duplex, right?
Right.
Was this loft capable of being locked with a key?
I believe the testimony of the special hearing was that it was, that there was a lock, and both Mr. Zatera and his wife had a key. So it was capable of being locked.
You mean Garlock or Zatera had a key?
I'm not Zatera. Mr. Kiefer and his wife had keys. It is not clear whether Mr. Garlock had a key. Mr. Kiefer testified. I believe Mr. Kiefer testified that Mr. Garlock did not have a key.
Well, it's not important about whether who had a key. What's important is whether or not the officers knew this.
Right, and it's... One of the officers, I believe Sergeant Bushy, testified that he did not believe, based on his observations at the scene, he did not believe there was a lock on the door. And he, furthermore, based on his observations at the scene, he observed Mr. Zatera open the door without even attempting, it was an unlocked door, and he just walked right in, which would lead, I would suggest, to lead a reasonable police officer to believe that Mr. Zatera, or Mr. Garlock, I'll get these names straight, Mr. Garlock had fairly free access to this place, whether or not there was a lock. And furthermore, Mr. Dawn Kiefer, the daughter of Mr. Garlock, testified that when asked, do you keep it locked, I think her answer was, quote, sometimes. So, and there's also no testimony from anyone that they refused access to Mr. Garlock at any time, or that they ever told Mr. Garlock to keep people out or to keep himself out. There's no indication of any agreement or any understanding between Mr. Garlock and the Kiefers that Mr. Garlock was to stay away, unless allowed in by them. Again, Mr. Garlock felt he could come and go, but he, out of respect, knocked on the door before entering.
What were the findings of the trial court?
Well, the trial court focused on the apparent authority doctrine, and basically the trial court concluded that the officers had sufficient information at their disposal to rely on the Illinois v. Rodriguez analysis. My recollection of the findings are that they are not detailed, but the court was impressed with the fact of Mr. Garlock's ownership, the lack of electricity or running water and phone service, Mr. Garlock's upset when learned that there were drugs on the premises, and his his statement of the officers that they could search anywhere. But ultimately, the court just concluded there were sufficient facts available to the officers for them to conclude that Mr. Garlock had the apparent authority.
And what's our review on the issue of both consent and on apparent authority?
Well, judging from the first argument this morning, I'm a little reluctant to tread into those waters. I think the easy way out is that there's no dispute there was consent here. There's absolutely no dispute
That makes it easier. And even in the first argument, there was a general consensus that consent is a fact issue. What about common authority?
The question of authority, I believe, is... In assuming there was valid consent, I believe the question of authority is a question of constitutional fact, which this court independently reviews in light of the facts developed below. And, for instance, in the apparent authority case, this court looks at the facts, the undisputed facts, the facts as found, the facts developed below to determine whether the facts available to the officers at the time of the search, and I would suggest at the moment they crossed the threshold of the loft, because that's where the search began, at the moment they crossed the threshold of that loft, were the facts available to the officers sufficient for officers of reasonable caution to believe that Mr. Garlock had the authority to let them into that loft? That is the question you have to answer in light of the facts developed below. And with respect to the common authority doctrine, in light of the facts developed below, this court has to determine whether Mr. Garlock had actual common authority over the premises or other significant relationship, I believe is the phraseology in Matlock, common authority or other significant relationship to the premises to allow him to search. And again, that is a legal determination this court must determine, but in light of the facts developed below.
Mr. O'Brien, once they get into the loft area, it's my understanding that Mrs. Kiefer asked whether they had a search warrant. What do you see as the significance of that question?
Well, it would be very significant if Mrs. Kiefer were the one charged here, but she was not. Mr. Kiefer was the one charged.
So that's the only protection that the Constitution provides? I find it almost an astounding principle to say that it's lawful for police to come and enter my home and search my home if my wife gives them permission, even though I am standing at the door saying you can't come in.
Well, the doctrine under both Matlock and Illinois v. Rodriguez, in most of the cases which follow those decisions, hold that where you, and I believe this court in West, that case can be read reasonably to hold that where people do have shared authority over a premises, even though one does not consent, the other may.
And so all I can say is the police rummage through my belongings is, well, I've got to take consolation in the fact that if you find anything incriminating against me, you can't use it in a court of law. Is that what you think the state of the law is, Mr. O'Brien?
I'm sorry, if you object to their being there and they find evidence against you,
they find evidence. You apparently believe that the state of the law is that if my wife gives permission to search my house, and I'm standing there simultaneously, and I say, no, you can't come in, and
the police
to search our house, and if they come in, the only consolation I have is that if they find anything incriminating against me, they can't use it against me in a case.
Well, I believe that's the state of the law. If you look at United States v. Mourning, the Federal Court of Appeals decision, and the Federal District Court decision in United States v. Wright out of Utah RITH, which documents lists a string of citations to that effect, that is the state of the law. Where two parties share common authority, one can consent.
Have those cases explored the lawfulness of that type of entry? I mean, because the Fourth Amendment is designed to do more than simply protect against the police getting incriminating evidence. It's designed to ensure my rights of reason of privacy, and that no searches be done except those that are reasonable.
And yet, as this court held in West...
Are you saying that it's lawful?
As this court held in West, your expectation of privacy is diminished to some extent by virtue of the fact that you're sharing your living quarters with someone else who could consent to a search of your property. Now, there are cases that limit that sort of a search. For instance, if you had a locked box in that house, the fact that your wife consented does not allow the police to go into your locked box. But if you share a locked box and she consents, then yes, they can open that box on her consent. It is a very delicate area. In a lot of these cases, Matlock was a case where Mr. Matlock was right outside in the yard. They didn't ask him for consent. They went right to the door and asked his paramour. And she said, go ahead and look.
He didn't object.
Morning, in the United States v. Morning, the paramour, Morning, was the one who said, you need a warrant. And then her friend, Lopez, said, no, you can come in and search. It's all in the back. They found all the evidence and used it against both of them. And the federal court, I'm not sure which circuit it was, but it's discussed at length in our brief, upheld that search.
I've read that brief.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. You have 5 minutes remaining to you. Mr. Birdsall, you represent Mr. Kiefer.
Madam Chief Justice, members of the court, I would like to just address, I'm not going to address any of the statement issues, rather just the search issues, and to start with, I would like to say that I would like to, I guess, make it clear what the state's burden was here, and that is to prove by clear and convincing evidence under State v. Rogers that the Matlock standard of common authority had been met, and that they had to show that there was joint access or control for most purposes, so that it was reasonable to recognize that any of the co-inhabitants have the right to inspect that property in their own right. In other words, that Matlock standard shows what actual authority would have to be. There was no actual authority here.
Mr. Birdsall, is the burden the same in regard to the apparent authority issue?
That's what I was coming up to. It would be, I guess, my interpretation. I think an accurate one to say that if we establish that no actual authority exists, so that we have to then go into trying to determine whether or not it was reasonable for them to conclude that authority was apparent, that belief would have to meet the standard, that they would have to reasonably believe that he had that actual authority.
Now, Mr. Counsel,
they have to prove that by clear and convincing evidence?
That would be my reading. Yes.
So the question was what I asked opposing counsel on the what the police knew at the time, and it's a question of the access to the law. Now, from what Mr. O'Brien indicated, he indicated that the police understood that sometimes the owner of the home could go into that loft. And that's a question here. In other words, the police wouldn't have time to determine exactly what his rights were or what he did, but as I understand the testimony, that it was their understanding that he could have, he being the owner of the home, had access to that loft area. But out of respect, as opposing counsel indicated, he would not. But sometimes it was my understanding that he felt he could go into that area. That's what the police knew at the time.
Obviously a very important issue. First, as a matter of fact, that was testified to, and this is just an aside to your question, but as a matter of fact, the testimony at the suppression hearing was, contrary to what was asserted earlier, that the specific understanding of both the Garlocks and the Kiefers was that the Kiefers expected to be able to exclude anyone from their apartment. They had a lock on the door, and they had the only set of keys.
But did they
and that included Mr. Garlock, I'm sorry.
Did they feel they had the absolute right at any time to use the other house facility to just walk in whenever they wanted? Because they didn't have plumbing, I assume they had.
I believe that was just part of their agreement. And as a matter of fact, I think that that does not speak to, that might speak to their ability to come into the main house, but it certainly doesn't speak to Mr. Garlock.
It might speak to their relationship with each other, though, as these two groups. I mean, the man is giving them rent free, he's giving them his plumbing. Obviously, unless they got extremely strong bladders, they're going to be coming there a couple times a day. And if they can enter just willy-nilly whenever they have to eat or want to, it speaks something about their relationship with each other.
It says that they can come in and use the main house. It doesn't say he can come in and sleep on their couch.
Let me ask you a question. Is the analysis what authority he had to enter the house, or is the analysis on apparent authority what the police knew at the time that they made the entry?
The latter, and that's what I was
thinking. Okay, all right, I'm going to take the next step then. Because then what becomes important, does it not, is what the trial judge found factually the police officers knew at the time of the entry. Not at the suppression hearing what people may say was the actual relationship.
Right. I agree.
Do you agree with that?
Yes. And I was coming up.
Okay, go ahead.
So, what did the trial court find? Right. He asked that of Mr. O'Brien, too.
Sure. The trial court found that Mr. Garlock, that he felt, the trial judge, he says, that the officers acted reasonably under the circumstances for the following reason. One, Mr. Garlock acted as though he had the authority consent. That's on page 3 of Volume 24 of the record. He acted as though he had the authority to consent. Two, they asked him about rent without defining that term, although it's statutorily defined, and the Manor case, certainly any monies paid for whatever reason can be considered rent for purposes of this analysis. So that was the second. That was the second thing that.
The response was.
The response was.
This is what the police officers knew about rent.
Right. They were informed he did not pay rent, although he did give some cash towards the electric bill. That is what he based his finding on. He continues, I'll quote right from the transcript. Their investigation and the answers given by Mr. Garlock at the time, that investigation was what I just described. And the eagerness displayed by Mr. Garlock to assist the police in ridding his premises of illegal drugs certainly supported the officer's belief in his authority to give consent. So the only actual investigation and the only specific fact that he found was necessary for these officers to reasonably believe that this man had common authority or joint access or control for most purposes was the fact that that they asked about rent, and they were informed that no rent was paid.
I asked Mr. O'Brien, did the police officers at this time know about the lack of plumbing? And that's my first part. And two, was that relied upon by the trial court in any way?
Yes and no.
Okay. Yes, what?
Yes, they knew, and no, I don't see anywhere in the trial in the trial court's ruling that that was even mentioned as a factor. But I will say this, there's, and I agree, that we need to look at, number one, what Garlock told them, or what they say Garlock told them. There's some conflict between those two, but just assuming the facts of what they say Garlock told them and what they observed, even assuming the truth of all of that, I would still submit that this was not a reasonable belief on the part of these officers. Garlock told them, Bushy testified that Garlock told them, this is volume 21, page 8 and 36, that he would lead them out to where Mr. Zatara was staying, in his daughter's and son-in-law's loft area of the garage. He used that possessive language. That was their loft area of the garage. He told them that. At that, and that was Bushy's testimony. So they knew that, one. They knew that money was paid for these folks to live there. We got into a little bit more specifically in the suppression hearing, but at that time, no matter how the money was paid, how much it was paid, how often it was paid, they knew money was paid for these folks to live there. They knew they were adults, and they were married adults. They knew it was a separate building. They knew there was a separate entrance. It's unclear whether they knew about the whole lock situation and the keys.
What did you mean by there was a separate entrance? It was my understanding there was just one entrance to this building. Is that not correct?
Well, there was actually two entrances. It's a garage with a loft area. There's an entrance from the outside into the garage area.
And that's just one entrance from the outside into the garage area.
From the outside into the garage area, correct.
At the top of the stairs, is there another one?
Yes. And I guess that would beg the question, are there locks on both doors? I don't know about the outside entrance.
It was a lock from the garage into the loft.
Excuse me?
It was a lock to the loft.
To the loft area, yes.
And that entrance to the loft area was through the garage, or was there separate?
No, the entrance to the loft area was through the garage.
Okay.
And they also knew what I was describing, some of the conduct and some of the visual observations they made. So they knew it was a separate building, and they also knew about, they were watching how he acted, and they were relying very heavily on this. Oh, he's so eager. He wanted to rid his premises of illegal drugs. Okay, well, that's understandable. That's speculation about his authority, and it's not an articulated fact that he can really use to rely on to make the determination whether he has common authority or joint access. But what they did, what they also observed, and Bushy testified to this, that there were things that Garlock did which would suggest to a reasonable person that, and particularly our police officer who's done this how many times, that he did not have joint access or control. For example, Bushy said, not that he just walked right in and waltzed right in, but in fact, he stopped and announced, and he poked his head through the door, and he announced that he was there and the police were there before they went through the door. Now, right there, wouldn't that be something for him to question about whether or not this man could come and go as he pleased? And if he could come and go as he pleased, he would just walk right in. That's what Bushy said. Preby and Otterbacher, both of the other officers present, both indicated that he knocked, and he announced himself. So these were some of the things that he knew about, that the officers knew about before they made that initial entry. Now, the question, I guess, before this court is, does that establish joint access or control? Or does that establish a reasonable belief that Garlock had that joint access or control for most purposes? But we know in fact that he did not. Now, there was some indication, I want to address a couple of issues brought up by Mr. O'Brien. (Clears throat) that there was some indication to the police officers at this time that they, that the Kiefers lived there with his, quote, permission, end quote. And in fact, they knew that there was this specific understanding. It wasn't just a, you can come and stay here for a little while. They knew that this was an area that they were occupying, that they paid money for, and that had been converted, and that they had done the conversion. So this was not this informal arrangement that seems to be suggested to them.
But they knew that Gerlach owned the property and that they lived there with his permission. That's what they were told at the time. So, I mean, it just seems reasonable that they would assume that these people were not, as in the ordinary sense, renting from month to month or had a lease or anything. So,
well, in fact, Officer Preeby testified that it was his understanding. He had testified at the suppression hearing, and I questioned him about his prior testimony at the preliminary hearing, that he believed that the Kiefers were renters. His words. And I'm referring to volume 21, page 58 there. Outerbacher said, in volume 23, page 57, that Gerlach told them the Kiefers, quote, paid money, end quote, to live there. All three of the officers agreed that they have a duty to do a sufficient investigation. None of them asked, not one of them asked, whether or not the Kiefers had the right to exclude people from that lot. Bushy didn't ask it. Bushy also didn't ask what Gerlach's normal course of practice was. Could he come and go as he pleased? Just didn't ask. He didn't ask whether the Kiefers had exclusive use of the lot. Didn't ask if there was a lock on the door. These are not overly burdensome questions. We're not asking the police to go into some extremely difficult analysis or to do something that would unduly restrict their ability to conduct searches. And in fact, these officers, just as an aside here, besides this whole apparent authority situation, these officers had ample opportunity to get a search warrant. The tip that they got originally was at 2:45 a.m. Bushy gets contacted at approximately 7 a.m. to go over there, and they arrive at 8:45 a.m. None of them, their testimony at all stages of this was that this was not a case of exigent circumstances. They weren't afraid of anybody fleeing the jurisdiction. They weren't afraid of any contraband being destroyed. They just wanted the easy way out. They wanted to go in and get consent. And they got it. But they're basing their quote-unquote reasonableness of their belief on Mr. Gerlach's apparent eagerness.
Let me ask you about this. I'm just thinking as you were arguing, the authority to exclude people. What relevance does that have if it doesn't relate to the ability to exclude Mr. Gerlach or members of his family? I mean, the fact that they can kick someone out of the house doesn't mean that Mr. Gerlach doesn't have authority over those premises, does it?
Well, I think it does, because
can't he let them have that authority and still maintain his authority over the premises? I mean, I can have visitors in my home that I have authority over my home, and I let them kick out somebody who comes in the front door. That doesn't mean that I can't give permission to search my house. for a police officer, simply because I have given that authority to them to be able to exclude someone. I mean, the question is whether they would exclude Mr. Garlock or members of his family contrary to his wishes, but it seems to me, if it's consistent with his wishes, that sort of begs the question.
Well, it seems that those would be competing authorities. Wouldn't they be mutually exclusive? I mean, if the Kiefers have, by agreement, the right to exclude any and all persons, they have the right to exclude the world from their home, including Mr. Garlock.
Including Mr. Garlock, that's my question. I mean, if their authority is to exclude Mr. Garlock or people that Mr. Garlock wants in, it may be relevant, but the fact that they can exclude people that may come in doesn't mean that that isn't with Mr. Garlock's okay and that he doesn't share authority with them. I mean, it seems to me that just doesn't answer the question.
Well, it speaks to his joint access and control for most purposes, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
And it says you don't have joint access or control for most purposes, and therefore you don't have common authority. And therefore, you flunk the Matlock test.
When they entered, did the defendant open the door then to the bedroom?
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
After they were in, the defendant open the door to the bedroom?
I believe that once they entered the apartment, and this brings me to my next issue, is that Dawn Kiefer, the defendant's wife, came out and requested a warrant. So they...
Well, didn't she say, do you have one, sir?
You have a warrant, that's correct.
She didn't request one.
She asked if they had a warrant, that is correct. And that's an issue I want to address in just 1 minute. But as to, if I understand your question, you're asking...
There is the premises.
Did they...
Whether it was legal or illegal, did he open the bedroom door for them?
Did John Kiefer open the bedroom door for the police? I believe they exited and left it open. That was my
understanding. The Kiefers came out and left the door.
Right. That was my understanding.
And then what did the police say? Can we go into your bedroom?
There's conflicting testimony about how that went down.
What's the testimony?
I believe the Bushy said that Mr. Kiefer went back in to get a soda. Excuse me, Preeby said this. That Mr. Kiefer went back in to get a soda, and he followed him for, quote, security purposes, end quote. And then the ensuing request.
But while he was in the bedroom, he saw the paraphernalia.
No, then I believe it was previous testimony that while they were in the bedroom, he said that, you do mind if I search? And he said that, the defendant said, sure, go ahead. And then he found a laundry basket, and in the laundry basket, under the laundry, with mushrooms. So.
And what was the other testimony?
The other testimony was that I believe Mr. Kiefer said, they just went in, asked me if they could search. I said no. And they did it anyways.
And what was the trial court finding?
I don't believe they reached the issue. I don't believe that they even found it necessary to reach the issue since...
Because the trial court found there was apparent authority.
Right, exactly. That's correct. Now, as to Mrs. I wanted to raise this point also, as to Mrs. Kiefer's request for, I don't even know how to phrase it, request for warrants.
Request for information.
Request for information, okay. The trial court specifically said, in its ruling, that was insufficient, which I don't know if they're trying to analogize this to an ambiguous Miranda request or something along these lines, but they specifically said more was needed on her part. She never asked him to leave the court.
I'd like to address the state's argument that it doesn't matter if she's not the focus of the criminal charge, the fact that assuming everybody had authority here, and I know that's the issue, but assuming everybody had the authority to consent to them searching it, it doesn't matter because her, even if she said you can't search, it wouldn't make any difference in this case. So I'd like you to address that argument, which is what the state argues.
Well, I think the answer is that if they have joint authority, her and her husband, over those premises, and she doesn't want those police there.
Well, let's assume Mr. Garlock has authority. For purposes of this analysis, Garlock has authority and husband and wife have authority, and Garlock has given them consent to search. I know you're challenging that, but let's assume it for this analysis.
Okay.
And she says, you can't search. I mean, she didn't say that either, but let's say she says, you can't search, and they search anyway. The state's argument is, as long as she's not the one who is charged, and so it doesn't matter, and if they had authority to search, they had authority to search, and the fact that one of the tenants objected doesn't matter. And I'd like to address that argument. Their argument is under current United States Supreme Court case, and maybe our West case, that it doesn't matter.
Well, first,
I know that's different than what the trial court found. But.
Right. I guess it would be my position that it indeed does matter, that at least as far as there are areas. I guess I need to further inquire if you're talking about him having the authority to grant consent for that entire premises, including her bedroom?
Why don't I just narrow that? The Court of Appeals on page 7 says, if two persons have equal rights in the premises and both are present at the time of the search, any evidence obtained is inadmissible against a non-consenting party, citing Robinson. So here, let's assume the husband and wife, just as Gusty added in the father-in-law, but the husband and wife have equal rights in the premises. There's nothing in the record to indicate otherwise. And let us assume, under Justice Gusky's statement, that the wife says no. Now, the husband is present, hears this, right? And the husband says nothing. Now, the police go in and search, on the theory that there is consent at least by one, or the one doesn't object. Under this, the fact that there's the wife that objected and she hasn't been charged, her disagreement or her failure to consent is irrelevant. That only his consent is important, or his failure to object. Do you agree with that statement of the law? We understand what I just said.
I do understand, I think, and I think my answer would be that, and it's always been my understanding, my reading of that Robinson case, that if both parties are there, if one party objects to the presence of the police there, then that ends their authority to be there, and they need to.
That's not what this says. I mean, as I read the Court of Appeals decision.
And it's certainly not. The state's argument is that the case law is clear that if one consents and one says no, they have consent. They simply cannot use evidence against the one who said no. And I mean, that's the state's argument. That's what the Court of Appeals seems to say.
Right, and another case that's not covered here is the one that Justice Bandlich gave you, with one party says yes, the other party isn't there. Then what is the...
My case was where one party says yes and the other party says no.
Okay.
And you rely on Robinson. I guess the bottom line of this is that it's the matter of the interpretation of Robinson that will answer that question, you believe?
That's the only answer I can give, I'm afraid. Yes. So, but in any event, I guess I have to conclude here by falling back on what the police knew at this time. And what they did know was that, for all the facts that I cited, what they actually knew, or what the police say that Garlock told them and what they observed, All of that put together, even assuming it's true, is not reasonable for them to assume that Garlock had joint access or control for most purposes, and that therefore this search was improper and unconstitutional. And so for all of those reasons, I guess, unless there's other further questions, I thank you.
And what about, why don't you just tell us about the Elstead issue?
Excuse me.
You got a few minutes. That is the attenuation issue on the statement.
Well, essentially my argument was that there was coercion in the bedroom interrogation. It was suppressed. The statements were suppressed. There was
coercion,
not a finding of
coercion. Coercion or promises?
Well, that's a matter of interpretation, I guess. And when it's Sunday morning and you're rousted out of bed, and a police officer tells you you're going to jail or you're not going to jail,
Weren't the facts here that he was promised leniency? Or do I have this case confused with another case?
No, his testimony was that he was promised that he would not be arrested for this offense.
It was that it would just be a parole violation.
He was on probation at
probation,
the time.
Probation, sorry.
Yeah, and he would merely be taken in and put on probation hold. That was what he was told, and so why don't you talk to us?
Judge make a finding as to that, whether that was in fact
judge
correct.
The judge he did well it wasn't clear if he made a finding on whether or not there was coercion. I believe he may have just been silent on that point because he didn't even reach it, because he just said, well, I'm going to suppress the statements in the bedroom because no Miranda was given, but not because there was coercion. So I believe that was his ruling. And then we went into the attenuation analysis, in which he found it was, the statements that the police department were sufficiently separated from any problems earlier. So did I address your issue?
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Mr. O'Brien, you have 5 minutes.
With regard to the statement, the testimony from the officers was clear that there was no promise of leniency. What the officer, Bushy, who questioned Mr. Kiefer in the bedroom, said was, they were interested in Zatera, and we would like your cooperation. We'll bring your cooperation to the attention of the authorities. And that is what the trial court found. And the Court of Appeals relied on that finding in concluding that there was no promise of leniency, and therefore there was no coercion. And another finding of fact at issue here, with regard to the consent to a search of the bedroom, the testimony of the officers was clear that Mr. Garlock or Mr. Kiefer did consent to a search of the bedroom, and that can be found at record site 21, 58 through 61, 72 through 73, 107 through 08, and the trial court found that he, in fact, did consent to a search of the bedroom. The Court of Appeals simply did not address that fact.
Was there an issue about voluntariness?
The trial court found the statements to be, with voluntariness of the statement at the police station?
No, the consent to search the bedroom.
There was no issue as to that. No. My understanding is there was no argument that, similar to a Wong Sun or an Anderson argument, that the statements were the tainted fruit of an illegal search. The only argument was that the statement at the police station was the tainted fruit of the illegal statement in the bedroom. And that plugs us into the Oregon v. Elstead analysis, where, in essence, the trial court found there was only a Miranda violation, but it was otherwise voluntary in the bedroom, and therefore, under Oregon v. Elstad, even though the trial court applied Anderson, the correct analysis is Oregon v. Elstad. Under Oregon v. Elstad, the statements at the police station, which were also voluntary, are admissible despite the earlier Miranda violation. I want to make one final point with respect to the living arrangements here, and I would insist that these really were informal, mutual right of access, sort of a relationship. And one important point is the familial nature of the relationship, the parent-child nature of this relationship. And there are numerous cases pointing out that in the area of common authority, the law presumes, absent anything to the contrary, that the parent has shared authority with the child who is living on the premises. And there, furthermore, with regard to the right of access, there are numerous cases, and I would especially point to the Iowa cases, the Oklahoma cases, and the Illinois cases cited in both of our briefs, where the important point of is the right of access, not the regular use by the parent. That if the parent has a right of access to the room, even if they rarely or never go into the room, they still have the shared common authority to consent to a search, absent anything that clearly shows to the contrary. And there was nothing here that showed to the contrary of Mr. Garlock's actual authority as a parent to consent to the search of his admittedly emancipated child's room. And of course, the fact whether the child was emancipated or not is relevant but not controlling, and this court in State v. Mears v. State, I believe, at 52 West 2nd, made that quite clear, that this is a special relationship whether or not the child is emancipated.
Do you think that the bearing of the father-in-law here, that is, he acted as if he had authority, showed no doubt about authority, which apparently the trial court relied on, do you think that's a good factor that the trial court or the police should rely on?
I think it is highly relevant to the apparent authority analysis, the Illinois v. Rodriguez analysis, but it's also relevant to the common authority analysis to the extent that you have this presumption of parental shared authority, and his actions are consistent with that legal principle, and there's nothing inconsistent. Not only are his actions relevant, their actions are also relevant. There was nothing when he walked in there.
Asking you about the attitude of the of a person as to the fact that he says he has authority, or he acts as if he has authority and shows great assurance. Is that a factor that the police can rely on?
I believe that is one of the facts available to the officers upon which the police can rely. In addition to the facts, they all also knew that he was an owner, he was an occupant, and he was a parent. Absent any further questions, I'll leave you there.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. That concludes the argument on State v. Kiefer. We are recessed until 1:45 p.m.